This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to Monday. We are live tweeting the program this hour at KUOW, and we're going to open with the drama happening now in Washington, D.C., where our system of choosing U.S. Supreme Court justices might be shifting. Senate Democrats are threatening to block President Trump's nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Republicans say, oh, we'll get him on the bench, even if it means changing the rules. And why should you care about a rule change? Well, here's New York Times Magazine staff writer Emily Bazelon. Good to talk with you again, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, what happened today in the Senate?
Well, the Democrats announced that they had crossed the threshold to filibuster Judge Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. So that means there are now 41 Democratic senators who are saying that they will not vote for what's called cloture. That's the when the Senate then sends the nominee to the floor. So essentially, the Republicans need 60 votes for Judge Gorsuch, under the current rules, and it doesn't look like they have them.
Right. So if the Senate Democrats block the nomination at this point, if they filibuster, Republicans have the votes to dissolve the filibuster, just make it so Supreme Court justices get by on 51 votes instead of 60. And why is that little 9-vote difference such a huge deal?
Well, if you think about it, you know, 50 or 51 votes is pretty partisan. Obviously, one party is, if there's, as long as there are only two, is going to have that number. Whereas if you have to get to 60, well, that's more of a kind of bipartisan lift to get the nominee through. So what we're seeing here is a kind of sharp partisan approach to approving Supreme Court nominations and a kind of future in which that's what we're looking at.
And what kind of Supreme Court justices could that future produce?
Well, if you think of bipartisan support as at least in theory producing nominees that are more moderate, then it's possible that in this more partisan era we seem to be entering that we'll have justices who play to the base on both sides, that, you know, Republicans will pick people who are more conservative and Democrats will pick people who are more liberal. I might also add that Republicans in particular have already picked fairly conservative justices. Gorsuch is someone who they didn't present him as a compromise. He is a nominee that they're very excited about. And, you know, you might argue the same for Democrats, too, although I don't think it quite applies to the same degree. But in any case, it's not clear how much of a moderating influence the 60-vote threshold is currently exercising. But it is a matter of Senate tradition. And so that's what we're seeing potentially go by the wayside.
Some observers say this nominee, Neil Gorsuch, he's not worth all of this. He's not as extreme as the next nominee might be if he doesn't go through. But you've written about this, Emily. Why do you think Gorsuch is more extreme than he seems?
Well, there's one issue in which he has taken a more, I think, right-wing position, and that has to do with the structure of the government and the authority of what we think of as the administrative state. So the current state of affairs, and it's really been the case reaching back into the 1930s and particularly since the 80s, the current law gives federal agencies a lot of power to make rules. And Gorsuch is skeptical about that and has talked about really making Congress do much more of that rulemaking. And the question is whether that's a realistic way for the economy, for modern regulation to function.
Well, I get the impression you think that that's I use the word extreme, but why would it be a problem that he's so, I don't know, is it anti-administrative state?
Right. Well, his skepticism about the current structure for the administrative state on the current court is only shared by Clarence Thomas. So even the other conservatives don't seem to be going as far as Gorsuch has signaled in his earlier opinions that he would. And so if we're thinking of the current court and its spectrum as the norm, then that's why I would say that on this issue, he is very much to the right.
You said something really interesting a moment ago. You said we could see a future of justices playing to the base, which is weird because what we've seen in my lifetime, justices, nominees, go in front of the Senate and say nothing. You know, they're so judiciously avoid taking any position. Do you think that could change?
Well, that's such an interesting question to ask. So on the one hand, there is other pressure to continue that kind of nomination, which is that judges want to appear as if they're separate from politics. And so it's uncomfortable at the Senate hearings for potential justices to be saying things that seem like they're politically attuned. But I also think that some of the pressure to not take any position on past cases, as well as current ones, really does come from trying not to give any ammunition to the other party. And so if that went away, people might be willing to be slightly more forthcoming.
We're talking to New York Times Magazine staff writer Emily Bazelon, who has been writing about the courts for years, and we've been following this. It's a partisan fight, as you said, that's going on. And I wonder, this is just a human curiosity. We want to point fingers, Emily. Is one side being more of a bully here than the other?
Well, the Republicans argue that the Democrats started this, and it is very much we're in the realm of that kind of playground talk. Their evidence for that is the demise of the nomination of Robert Bork. This is back in 1987. Bork was viewed by the Democrats as really extreme on the right, and they voted down his nomination. And at the time, that was a break with the norms. Before that, the Senate basically let the president pick someone. Since then, things have ratcheted up, and as I'm sure you remember and a lot of your listeners do, when former President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, the Republicans were in control of the Senate, and they refused to give Garland a hearing and created this new rule for them where they said that in the president's last year in office that his nominee should not get a hearing or a confirmation vote. So you can kind of see that we have like an arms race going on that has brought us to this current state of affairs.
And it sounds like you're not going to let on which you think was the bigger, I don't want to say sin, but, you know, Bork versus Garland. Do you have an opinion about which was the more shocking disintegration of the norms of our decision-making process?
Well, I guess I would say that, you know, to not even give Merrick Garland any kind of hearing and to essentially take away the power of the president to nominate a Supreme Court justice in his last year in office, that was unprecedented and just not really how advise and consent looks like it's supposed to work in the Constitution. Whereas voting down the Bork nomination, while it was a big, you know, explosion at the time, that seems like if you look at the Constitution's provision for advise and consent, it seems like more in line with the purpose of the Constitution. But I want to emphasize that there's a kind of shared history here. It's
yes.
Not all one side.
Yes. Okay, two more questions for Emily Bazelon. Number one, this long wait for a Supreme Court justice since Antonin Scalia died, it feels long and dramatic. How rare is it actually?
It's unusual, very unusual to have an opening for this long. You know, after the Bork nomination went down and it took President Reagan a couple more tries to get someone through, there was a vacancy. But this vacancy is going to be in the end, you know, almost a year long, more than a year long. And so that is, I'm not sure if it's unprecedented for the court, but it is a long time and it has affected the way the court does business.
Finally, a small item that I noticed, Emily, one of the Democrats who will not vote to block Gorsuch's nomination at this point anyway is from Colorado. Do you think
he's
supporting a Supreme Court justice nominee of the other party's choice because they're from his state?
Yes, I do think that's probably very much part of the calculation. So we're talking about Senator Michael Bennet from Colorado. Judge Gorsuch is from Colorado. Senator Bennet introduced him to the hearings, and I imagine that Bennet feels that the voters of Colorado are going to be displeased if he goes against a kind of legal rock star from his own state.
That always amazes me. This is bigger than politics. This is home state identification we're talking about now.
I'm not sure anything is bigger than politics, right?
Right. Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer. Good to talk with you again, Emily. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
And finally, speaking of home state identification, if I told you that one of the teams in tonight's NCAA basketball championships was Oregon State, you might say, eh, it's nice for them. Even though Seattle and Corvallis, Oregon, share a freeway and often a weather forecast. Corvallis is closer to us than Spokane is. You will probably never set foot on Spokane's Gonzaga University campus. You'll probably never meet any of this year's 7,000 graduates, but they are in Washington State. So tonight, it's Go Bulldogs or Go Zags. Both are acceptable. KUOW's The Record on the 3rd of April, a Monday. I'm Bill Radke, and as I speak, city crews are loading up those lime green bikes you may have seen people riding around Seattle. The bikes were part of Pronto, Seattle's bike share program, a short-lived bike share program. The city killed it because not enough people were riding those lime green bikes. Pronto launched in 2014 with 500 bikes, and that first year saw fewer than 150,000 trips. By comparison, Washington, D.C.'s bike share program started a few years earlier with 1,100 bikes, so more than double, and more than 1 million trips. Whew, Seattle just blew a big opportunity here with Pronto, if you believe Ryan Packer, who has been using Pronto since day one. On Friday, Ryan shared his final morning Pronto commute with KUOW's Matt Martin.
Staring at the Pronto checkout screen at Denny and Summit on Capitol Hill, Ryan Packer notices something different about the computer system he's used for the past 2 years.
24-hour pass, you can't buy a three-day pass anymore. It's the last day.
Ryan has logged over 2,000 trips on Pronto. He bikes from Capitol Hill down to his job at Zeke's Pizza each morning.
When we get up here, the bike lane's going to disappear, so we have to go into the turn lane.
But in addition to slinging pizza, Ryan is also the senior editor at the Urbanist blog. He's thought a lot about bike share.
Let's go up to second.
Ryan believes bad design is one reason bike share wasn't successful here. Bad design of both the Pronto system itself and bike lanes around the city.
It's like a big Rube Goldberg machine to feel safe riding from one point to the other. It should be seamless and it should be serendipitous. You can't really just pick up a bike and head somewhere.
You know, one of the keys to a successful bike share system is size. Size matters.
Gabe Klein used to run one of the most successful bike share programs in the country, Capital Bike Share, in Washington, D.C.
And so I think that fundamentally the most important thing that you can do when you're launching a bike share system is to make it big enough and have enough utility for it to be a primary mode of transportation, not a secondary or tertiary mode.
But Derek Hicks thinks there's actually a different problem. He lives in Seattle and has used Pronto once or twice. And he says for people who actually want to ride their bikes to get around the city, it's weird to have to borrow one.
People that do bike around own their own bikes. So there are a group of people that would not be interested in sharing bikes. They simply own them, and they're the ones that are willing to go up and down the steep hills and around. But people that bike less, that would want to rent bikes, are not willing to do the very serious biking.
The city had budgeted $3 million for Pronto. Mayor Ed Murray says that money will now be used to improve other pedestrian and bike projects. Ryan isn't optimistic. He says that won't be as beneficial if Pronto had been fully fleshed out. He says the city is going to be worse off in the long run if we don't find a way to make a bike system sustainable. But in the meantime, Ryan Packer will just be walking to work.
I'm going to ride a couple more times today, but it's going to be a bummer.
For KUOW, I'm Matt Martin.
Yes, it's always difficult when something has passed on, and we asked you on social media to write Pronto's obituary. If you were the obit writer, what would you say? Chad says, Pronto died at the bottom of a hill, soaking wet and deep in debt. The Seattle Bike Blog contributed a little darker version. 29-month-old baby Pronto tragically died of starvation while its parents argued over the best way to feed it. Ouch. Cecilia says, rest in peace, Pronto. Thanks for returning the parking spaces. Oh, yeah, those bike racks, I guess, will be parking spots again. And Tim finally says, Pronto helped me get home in time to put my young daughter to bed so many times when South Lake Union buses weren't up to it. Thanks. Those comments from listeners who follow us on Facebook and Twitter, you'll find us on your favorite social network when you search for KUOW. And we are asking you, so the Pronto program is done, but what would it take? If not Pronto, then what? What would it take for you to ride your bike more, to actually use your bicycle as one of your primary forms of transportation? Let us know right now, because we have guests to talk to you about it. 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. We're joined by Mark Hallenbeck, who is a bike commuter.
I am right now.
And by the way, with the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. Hi.
Hi.
Again, we're at 543-5869 asking, what would it take for you to ride your bike more? And leaving Pronto, Mark, what was your take on what happened with this bike share program?
My take is relatively straightforward. They didn't get enough riders given the city investment, but the city also caused problems with the people who were running Pronto. The whole, we're going to take over this, and that limited their ability to do independent fundraising. So there were a variety of management aspects to this that also caused them problems. So death by a thousand cuts, maybe. How's that my version? It's not nearly as good as the poetry you were just reading, though.
Right. It's pretty good. Well, you just heard there was an argument over whether when you do bike share, you've got to go huge. You've got to make it connected and big and everywhere and visible, and you got to market it, and it's got to be instantly a utility. Like, yeah, that's part of the transportation grid. I get it right away. And that Seattle, some people say it was just too small, didn't have enough of an impact.
There's an argument to be made there, but I don't think that's the issue really in Seattle. I think there are bigger issues about it being a utility. There's a safety factor. Do you really feel that this is a safe matter? The concept of size really means, can you get to where you need to go by this mode? And there's an awful lot of terrain features in this city that make that a difficult proposition, even though it exists. It's well known in Pronto that a lot of people took bikes in the morning on Capitol Hill and rode down to downtown Seattle. They didn't take them back the other way.
The bikes only work downhill.
They work downhill. It's not so much that they don't work downhill. They work on downhill and flat. Those are two out of the three.
True.
But that creates, when you look at the city and you're trying to go from one part of the city to another, there are an awful lot of hills involved that really limit your ability to say, oh, this is big, this makes sense. And the reality is there are part of that using the technology that we're using, there were a lot of trips that even if it was big, wouldn't have been made. How much of that versus the helmet law, that's definitely a restriction. How much of that versus the weather, that's definitely a restriction. I mean, there are lots of different cuts in the thousand cuts that all played a part.
We're taking your call at 206-543-5869. What would it take for you to ride your bike more? And we have on the line Kelly Mesher, whose job it is to figure out how to get more people to use bikes as transportation. She's the Puget Sound Policy Manager with Cascade Bicycle Club. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, fine. What concerns and barriers to bicycling do you hear people most talk about?
Well, by far and away, the biggest concern we hear from folks is that they don't feel safe riding a bike in Seattle. And I think there's a couple of components to that. First, riding a bike in an urban environment is a skill like anything else. A lot of us, when we learned to drive, started out in a parking lot, getting comfortable with that, and then slowly made our way onto neighborhood streets and out into traffic. And it's the same with riding a bike. You have to practice and feel comfortable and then learn how to ride in the city.
Well, is there something about Seattle that makes people feel less safe than any place else?
Well, I think the other factor I was going to mention is that, folks need safe and protected places to bike. And so, that relates to how we build our infrastructure in the city. Cascade and other safe streets advocates are really interested in seeing the city build out a network of connected bike lanes so that people of any age or any skill level can feel safe getting around the city, getting to the places that they want to go.
Yeah, that echoes some of our listeners right now. Right on Twitter, for example, Aurelia says, protected lanes or separate trails. Frank says, a physical separation between dedicated bike lanes and the road. And Natalia writes on Facebook, bike infrastructure that protects riders and makes it clear that bikes also have a right to the roads. And are those issues having anything to do with Pronto, or just they're still there even with Pronto gone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really too bad that Pronto has gone away for now. But I do think that for someone who's not used to riding regularly, that picking up a bike in a busy downtown area and then sharing the road with, you know, cars and delivery trucks is a pretty scary thing to do. So I hope that when we try bike share again in the future, we'll have a more built out, protected network of safe places to bike, and more people will feel comfortable taking those short trips.
One more question for you, Kelsey. You said something that surprised me. You were telling us that there is another barrier, which is seeing hardcore-looking bicyclists around town in spandex, basically. Will you explain that?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, people who maybe don't ride regularly might have a perception. The cyclists that are often very visible are, you know, suited up and ready to go for a long recreational ride, and it might just seem like, that's not something that's for me. But in reality, you know, people use bikes all over the world for different reasons. You can ride in your regular clothes. You can use a bike for a short trip, maybe to link up with light rail or a bus stop, or to just, you know, go meet up with a friend at a restaurant down the street. And biking can really fit into your life however you want it to fit. So you don't need to go all the way to enjoy bicycling and reap the benefits of it.
Aren't there companies that specialize in non-alienating looking bike wear?
Yeah, there are, and there's more options popping up around the city all the time.
Kelsey Mesher, Puget Sound Policy Manager with Cascade Bicycle Club, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
We're talking about the demise of Pronto, the bike share program, and bigger issues with bicycling in general. And Steve is on the line in Linwood. Steve, hello.
Hi there.
What's the issue you want to highlight?
Well, for me, I was a regular bike commuter from my Green Lake location down to Pioneer Square back in the early 2000s. It's a fabulous ride. It was about 5 or 6 miles each way, and I really enjoyed it until I found that every single day involved some confrontation over, you know, sort of lane rights with someone in a car. And I wasn't going to win that battle at my, you know, 25-pound bicycle versus the 2,000-pound car. Now, in contrast, I work in Linwood, which is about an 11-mile one-way trip, and I ride the Inner Urban Trail, which is spectacularly relaxing. It does everything that a bike ride should. I'm only coming up against against cars every 10 blocks or 5 blocks, and I can manage that. But it's the last. For me, it starts at about 110th down to where I live around 75th, that I've got about 35 blocks of just, frankly, hair-raising traffic with people. I said earlier, it's people looking down at their cell phones, you know, texting while they're driving. And despite my garishly colored outfits, somehow people don't see me. And every day I'm on the bike, I feel seriously life-threatened. And that kind of ruins your commute, if you see my meaning.
Steve, still garish in Linwood. Thank you, Steve. So there's Steve's answer to that question. The thing other people were saying, protection, separation, and he's got a trail. Mark Hallenbeck, do you see, we're going to move on to other transportation issues, bigger, physically, literally bigger. But last question on bikes. Do you see bicycles in our lifetime becoming the integrated Seattle transit option that some people dream of?
Yeah, I think it's distinctly possible.
Is it on the way? Is it happening?
They're making the reasonable good first steps towards doing it, thanks to a lot of advocacy work, but also because as the area becomes denser and more mixed in usage, that sets up bikes to be much more competitive in the environment. And they take up relatively little space as a result of their small size. And that's good when you're in a dense environment. Space becomes precious. And so things like bikes become really good. If you look at Amsterdam in the 1970s and late 60s, it was very car oriented. If you go there now, it's incredibly bike centric. So is it possible? Sure, we could follow that same path, and it's distinctly possible that we will.
Meanwhile, let's move to the very car-centric program that is the transit tunnel. We have Bertha about to crown here, emerge from the earth any day this week, after quite a journey. The boring machine was stuck down there, hit a pipe, it leaked at the seals, got gritty, and it was stuck for almost 2 years. It looks like, and we're worried, what's it gonna, what if it breaks down under skyscrapers? Well, near the Space Needle, this week it's going to emerge. I would love to see that video, by the way. My question for you is when, that's just the first step, right? So when this tunnel...
The hard step.
The hard, yes. The first, the hard early step. When this tunnel is actually complete, what do you think traffic will look like in the Seattle area? Any different?
Well, definitely it'll look different, but how different is I can't predict because I don't know what the policies will be. A lot will have to do with how expensive the tunnel is, and a lot will have to do with...
Why? What does the expense of the tunnel have to do with the traffic picture?
Well, if you look at 520, you put a toll on 520, you didn't really change anything else in terms of driving capability at that instant in time, and like 15% of the traffic all went away.
And this is a toll tunnel.
And this is a toll tunnel. And so there will be a bunch of people who, no matter, your options, if you don't use the tunnel, are going to be surface streets through downtown or on the waterfront, or they're going to be going over to I-5. And none of those are great options. But if you ask anybody who's using I-90, I-90 is not a terribly great option either, but we still had a whole bunch of people go over to I-90 to avoid paying the 520 toll. So if the toll is too high on the tunnel in downtown, then all those people will either be on the surface or they will be on I-5, or we would hope that they instead hop in, you know, the new rapid ride routes that show up to help transport people. If everybody gets on buses, life will be great. If everybody tries to drive through downtown Seattle will suck. Although it might be moving so slowly that the bikes will be great because you'll just zoom on by in the bikes. I-5, if everybody goes over to I-5 because downtown sucks, I-5 will be even worse, although the people who will really suffer from that will be Shoreline. So they're going to have to find the sweet spot that the toll prices aren't so high that you push too many people away. You want people to use the tunnel. If as many use the tunnel as use the viaduct today, it'll be great.
What's the final thing we ought to know, Mark Hallenbeck with the State Transportation Center, University of Washington, about our travel life, our commuting life?
Always look for doing different, better options. Try every once in a while something different, whether it's walking or biking or taking the bus or, you know, sharing your carpool. If you look for different ways to get around, the new modes are showing up, new options are showing up, and they often involve things that improve everybody's lives. So look to be...
That's true. If you're in a rut, you might not know all the stuff that's actually going on. Like, options may have changed for you. Look into it.
The biggest thing about One Bus Away and Google being able to map your bus is you can actually figure out how you can go from where you are to where you need to be on a bus. That's a huge thing, getting around the unknown. That's a really great option. So be creative. Try every once in a while to do something different. You might find a really good option.
With the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington, it's Mark Hallenbeck who got here by either foot or bike.
Bike to work, foot from work to here.
Yeah, not bad. And you're looking in good shape, too. Thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
It's KUOW's The Record. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Washington legislators are working away this year to finally solve our school funding crisis. A lot of the lawmakers' work is happening behind the scenes and in closed-door meetings. So who's behind the door? Who's in the meetings? Who's trying to influence the outcome? We asked the top four leaders of the legislature to release their emails and calendars, and they said no. KUOW's Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the Seattle Times.
The request was fairly straightforward. We wanted copies of office calendars for the leaders of the House and Senate, Democratic and Republican caucuses. We also asked for emails or other communications related to the state budget or education funding. The answer back was, the legislature does not have any public records that are responsive to your request. That doesn't mean the records don't exist. Effectively, the lawmakers were saying, we're exempt.
It's not really even an exemption, it's actually part of the definition of public record.
This is former Republican State Representative Toby Nixon, who now heads the Washington Coalition for Open Government. He says there's a narrow definition of what constitutes a legislative public record.
And then there's a large swath of records, basically any records that are in the possession of a legislator, their communications, their calendars, other things they have in their office that are not considered public records by definition.
This troubles Nixon.
Sunshine is the best disinfectant, right?
Washington isn't the only state where lawmakers shield their records from disclosure. Last year, the Associated Press made public records requests of lawmakers in all 50 states. Those requests were denied in part or in full in more than 35 states. Among the states that do require lawmakers to release their records are Oregon and Idaho. So does Arizona, where Morgan Lowe works as an investigative reporter at CBS 5 Television in Phoenix.
One of the things that I find interesting about lawmaker emails, and one of the reasons I think they're so important as public records, is they give you an idea of the mindset of the lawmaker and the intent behind legislation.
Lowe gives the example of an Arizona state senator who made national headlines in 2010 for his efforts to require local police to enforce immigration laws. Lowe wanted to know what was happening behind the scenes, so he requested the senator's emails.
And what we found out from his emails was that he was preparing to author another bill that would take away birthright citizenship here in Arizona.
That became a story on the evening news.
We looked through hundreds of emails sent to and sent by State Senator Russell Pierce.
Now, in Washington, nothing prevents lawmakers from voluntarily releasing their records. We asked the four top legislative leaders to do that after they denied our initial request for records. Through their lawyers, they said no. The lawmakers also declined our requests for interviews for this story. Speaker of the House Frank Chop did issue a one-line statement. It reads, "I'm open to reviewing how the Public Records Act applies to the legislature after session adjourns." House Republican leader Dan Christensen said he's open to that too.
House Bill 1595, the clerk will read.
This year, the Washington House is advancing legislation related to the state's Public Records Act. It's sponsored by Republican Terry Neely, and it would let local governments deny some broad requests for public records and charge fees for others. Neely says he's trying to relieve cities and towns from harassment and expenses. Asked if legislative records should be public, Neely says he has those same concerns.
And so that's why I'm a little extra cautious on how we design it to fit the legislature. But having said that, we're just like everybody else, so we need to be treated like everybody else.
But it's clearly a touchy issue. Former State Representative Toby Nixon says when he was in the legislature, he was pressured to withdraw a bill he introduced to require that legislative records be made public. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're just getting word now that Seattle's mayor has walked away from the homelessness property tax levy, the $275 million levy, and maybe we'll work instead on a sales tax increase. We'll certainly have more details as that story becomes clearer. Now on The Record, we're going to talk about crime and faith. In Washington state prisons, 85% of the faith-based ministries for inmates are Christian. 85%. That's typical in the U.S. If an inmate wants to get involved in anything that isn't daily prison life, often their only option is Christian faith-based ministry. Professor Tanya Erzin wanted to know how this came to be and how it affects people. She teaches religion and gender studies at University of Puget Sound. She told me the rise in Christian ministries is happening in part because public spending on prisons has dropped.
What has stepped in to fill that gap are primarily religious organizations, and they're primarily conservative. But prisons have been religious from the very beginning. The first prisons in Pennsylvania and New York were penitentiaries. They were created by Quakers and Methodists. If you think about that term, penitentiary, to be penitent, they were started by Quakers who believed that they'd put people in individual cells. You would find the inner light within you and that you would be transformed through a relationship with God.
So today's Christian-based programs in a prison, what kind of programs are those typically?
They really vary. So there are major prison ministry organizations. The biggest, one of the biggest, is called Prison Fellowship Ministry, and it was run by and started by Chuck Colson, who went to prison for Watergate-related crimes,
right,
and became born again. And so he started this organization that operated throughout the country but took over entire wings of prisons. And every prison has a chaplain, and chaplains just historically tend to be Christian, so they can really determine who comes in. So if a chaplain happens to be Southern Baptist in Central Florida, you know, the majority of religious volunteers coming in are going to probably be from that religious background.
And these are not just Bible study programs. This is education assistance and counseling, right? Give us an idea what services these are.
If you think about religious groups come in, they do trauma counseling, they do mental health counseling, they do high school GED, they do college programs, they do things like anger management, but with an evangelical framework. And some of the programs I looked at in the South particularly are the Baptist seminaries have offered the only college degree programs in prisons. So the option is if you want to go to school, you get a degree in Christian ministry, and they then take men and women from those prisons and move them to another prison in the state. So in Texas and Louisiana, there's no shortage of prisons. And the idea is to have them proselytize to other prisoners. They call it moral rehabilitation because they have to avoid the idea that they are proselytizing.
Does an inmate have to say they're Christian to take advantage of this range of programs?
No. Legally, they can't because that's violating, you know, the First Amendment. But there are very, very few non-Christians in those programs. So when I interviewed people, there were a small handful of Muslims, but most people identify as Christian. Because if you think about it, the bulk of the classes are around, you know, how do you reach someone's heart who's not a Christian, you know, looking specifically an entire class on the book of, you know, studying Jeremiah in the Bible. So, you know, you really have to be motivated to want to get an education if you're not part of that religious tradition.
You mentioned you talked with Muslim inmates. Mm-hmm. What do non-Christian inmates tell you about all of this?
Well, I talk a lot about in my book, he was in this program in Texas. And he was one of, I think, the only person in his class who was Muslim. And he just said, you know, this is my only, I am a Muslim. They're not going to convert me, but this is the only opportunity I have. And he was so shocked that they let him talk to me. We were in a room with no one else around. You know, obviously there are guards walking around, but he kept saying, are you a church lady? No. Are you a police officer? No. I mean, it took a long time for him to just open up. And then he kept laughing. He kept saying, I'm never allowed to talk about this. He talked about how frustrating it is to feel like you're trying to learn, but there are always people who are not undermining, but challenging your particular beliefs. So, and then in Florida, the Muslim group would meet. They had this giant chapel. It's Central Florida. It's the only air-conditioned building in the entire prison, and you can imagine what it's like there. They sleep in these big open dormitories. This evangelical megachurch had redone the chapel. There was a huge TV screen. There were musical instruments. There was air conditioning. And then the Muslim group was allowed to meet, and it essentially was a glorified broom closet. And the warden at the time said to me, I was just visiting, what do you think? I'm thinking of eliminating recreation time, so time that people can go outside, and requiring people to be in the chapel. There's all of these levels of coercion that happen in prison. And I think when you have limited choices and those are the only choices presented to you, that's what you're going to take advantage of.
What does all this look like here in Washington State prisons?
Washington's interesting for a lot of reasons. They have a lot of faith-based groups, but they're, especially in the women's prison, are really shifting to want professional groups who can do things like addiction and mental health and counseling that aren't coming from a faith-based orientation. One thing I'm really interested in is just how these programs affect women, and I work with women here in Washington. I do a college program. Statistically, I think 93% of women in prison have reported domestic violence, sexual abuse, or violence as a child. And so there's this astronomical amount of women who have some kind of trauma, you know, coupled with whatever got them there. There's a lot of addiction, and there just are not the mental health and other programs to help them. And so still you have religious groups coming in to try and work on things like trauma or dealing with rape or dealing with abuse. And while I think those services are necessary, a lot of them end up being about, well, you know, surrender your problems to Jesus. If you submit to God, if you submit your problems to God, that's how you will get better. And I think that's, you know, I think there should be other kinds of services and ways in thinking about how to deal with that problem.
We're talking with Professor Tanya Erzin, Associate Professor of Religion, Gender Studies at University of Puget Sound, and we're talking about the predominance of Christian prison ministries in our public prisons. Have we missed talking about the positives of these groups?
Yeah, I think there are, or they wouldn't continue to exist. And someone once posed the question to me, are these ministries just another form of discipline and punishment, or do they provide a lifeline for dignity and transformation for people inside? And I think it's both. I think they do both. I think what they enable for a lot of people is it gives them a sense of belonging and community in prison. Those people I talked about who are serving life, after a while, you have no family visit you. You don't have anybody on the outside. Your whole world is a prison. So if you're part of a faith-based group, you get to meet people coming in who are free people. You develop those relationships, which I think is really important. And I think the prison system is really designed to dehumanize people. So you're called offender or inmate, you know, inmate Radke, instead of your first name or referred to as a person. And in a faith-based group, I think there is a humanizing process that happens because a lot of people feel that they are, especially if they're Christian believers, they feel that they have a personal relationship with God, that God cares about their life, that they're forgiven, that they can be redeemed. And that is a real shift from a model that says, you're a horrible person, you committed a crime, you're going to prison for the rest of your life. We forget it, you're incorrigible, as opposed to, we believe that you can be different and that you can be transformed. My criticism is that with so many religious groups and so many prisons who have day-to-day contact with people in prison, and probably know more about people in prison than anyone except people's families, they're the ones who could say, why in Louisiana do so many people get life without parole? Why is this considered a normal sentence? Why are we sending more women to prison than we've ever sent before? Why are we sending a woman with 5 small children to prison for a nonviolent offense as opposed to another kind of intervention? They have the constituency, they have a mouthpiece to really make, you know, say things broader about changing sentencing and changing the policies and politics around this, but so many of them are focused on individual conversion and not on the broader picture about why is the prison there in the first place and why are there so many people in it. So I think I'm hopeful that religious groups can start to ask those bigger questions.
Finally, Tanya, most people listening to you right now haven't been in prison. Many don't know anybody in prison. Why is this an issue the rest of us should all be thinking about?
Sure. Because the United States is truly exceptional in that we incarcerate more people in proportion to our population than anywhere else in the world. And it's continuing to skyrocket. Here in Washington, just if you're listening, the women's prison is way overcrowded. Women are the fastest growing part of the prison population. And I actually think a lot of people do know and are directly impacted by this because eventually most people get released from prison. They rejoin community. They have to have a job. They have to have housing. And the question I have for people, do you want to have a system in which we're trying to help people to figure out how to transform and change their lives so that when they get out, they can be a full citizen? Or do you want to just warehouse people, astronomical numbers of people who then get out and have mental health problems, lack of education, whose families don't have the resources to succeed? Because I think that harms all of us as a society. And I think it's an ethical and political issue. We have to find a better solution to how we think about punishment.
Tanya Erzin is Associate Professor of Religion and Gender Studies at University of Puget Sound, and she runs the Freedom Education Project Puget Sound, which is a college program in our state's Corrections Center for Women. Erzin's book is called God in Captivity: The Rise of Faith-Based Ministries in an Age of Mass Incarceration, and we're tweeting out a link right now to one of her articles on Christian ministries in prisons. So join us at KUOW. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Amazon.bomb. That was the cover story in Barron's in 1999. The story asked, when will this company actually turn a profit? Right now, Amazon stock is at its all-time high, around $889. And experts say it might soon be a trillion-dollar company, trillion-dollar company. There is some upheaval happening at Amazon, particularly when it comes to groceries. Let's get the big picture now from GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
Amazon just surprised some people by shutting down diapers.com, soap.com, beautybar.com, et cetera, yoyo.com, whatever that is. What's happening at Amazon?
So a bunch of stuff. So the Quidsi acquisition, which was diapers.com, they acquired that for about $545 million 7 years ago. That was a company that they say they could not get to profitability, although there's a new report out today that Quidsi was actually headed toward profitability this year. So that one is a little bit uncertain, unclear on exactly what's going on there.
Well, what else would it be except Amazon not thinking it's going to make enough money for Amazon to bother dealing with it?
7 years ago, diapers.com, 7 years ago and prior, was a very significant Amazon competitor for a very specific part of its business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one way to take competitors out of the landscape is to acquire them.
Ah.
And so you can sort of see the dynamic now. Whether that was actually what they were doing there, it's unclear, but obviously the momentum is now going toward Amazon's own diapers business, and so there's some strategic business stuff perhaps happening behind the scenes there.
I see. In Seattle, Amazon's been developing their brick-and-mortar Amazon Go store in South Lake Union. It's the store where you walk in and take stuff off the shelf and walk out. No register, no cashier, no human interaction necessary. Remind us why Amazon Go is on hold.
For now, the reports are that Amazon Go and the technology behind it is not working exactly like Amazon wanted. If you have too many people in the store or they move too quickly, the sensors are not picking up what they're doing. And of course, that's key to the cashierless checkout technology. So the idea, as you said, is to just walk in, scan your phone when you walk in, and then the store tracks you going around it, much like it would track you going around a website. But the tracking is not working as well as it should.
Well, that store sounds really technically hard to pull off. I mean, should it be surprising that they're still working on it, or is this a big deal?
I think ultimately Amazon Go will open and it will be at least a technological success. The question is whether it'll be a market-based success and whether it'll ultimately spread out across the country. But Amazon would not have announced that publicly if it were not at least somewhat confident that the technology was going to come through. Now, keep in mind, it's just Amazon employees in a private beta for now, even though they've announced it publicly.
Right. Now, meanwhile, more public is the Amazon Fresh Pickup stores opening in Ballard and Soto. How important are these?
These are a fascinating development because it's one more example of Amazon trying to get just a little bit closer to its customers and increasingly being willing to go beyond the borders of its apps and its website. The idea behind Amazon Fresh Pickup is that you order your groceries online, schedule a time to pick them up at the store, and then you actually go there and they bring them on out, and it's a very Amazon experience. Now, this is also only launching as a private beta for Amazon employees, which is a little bit odd in the neighborhood because it's this very high-profile location. It's right there on 15th Avenue Northwest as you come off the Ballard Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, for now, it's just Amazon employees. They're clearly giving a little bit of a sneak peek here, but being very careful about how they roll these things out.
One more food note. Some packaged food giants will visit Amazon this spring in Seattle to discuss shipping Oreos, et cetera, straight to online shoppers instead of to store shelves?
That's right. So think about like a bottle of Tide. How confident would you be in that bottle of Tide getting to you in a package with a bunch of other stuff without leaking? Not very confident, at least that is the concern. So one thing they're talking about is improving the packaging to make sure that those things don't happen, they don't leak, and that a variety of other packaged goods actually are appropriately packaged for online distribution versus sending in big trucks to your neighborhood grocery store.
Oreos are in these flimsy...
Exactly.
They're made to be crinkly and colorful and light and all that stuff. Is Amazon saying, look, just eventually stop shipping to the Walmarts altogether? That would be a revolution if you just didn't... You know, that now we're talking, oh my God, you're not shipping to store shelves. But that's not the vision.
They certainly want a greater share of the overall purchasing by consumers. The real impact here is if Amazon starts setting standards for the way that these things are packaged in a way that also influences the way they're packaged in the store. You could see one kind of standard packaging emerging from this effort. This was a report by Bloomberg News, by the way, that came out with this insight into these meetings. Really, you're starting to see Amazon go beyond the basics here. They've got the web stuff nailed, and obviously they're going to continue to refine that, but they're getting to the point where they've got to make advances beyond their core technologies. And so you're seeing all these various efforts beyond just the website.
How important is this to Amazon, and what I care as a customer? Is this going to change my life if the makers of Oreos start shipping them in bomb-proof pallets?
I can tell you, for a lot of people who use Amazon, things like frustration-free packaging, which they've tried to do similarly in terms of setting a standard, that is a real game changer in terms of being able to open up something without having to take a hacksaw to it.
Yes.
So if they can do things that simplify the customer experience and end up rippling out into the rest of the industry, then it is a big deal. It's not a huge game changer, but if they can do it also in a way that gives them more market share, convinces these Procter's and Gamble's of the world to essentially cater to Amazon before they cater to traditional stores, that is an important tipping point.
So we've been giving you a few notes here and there about what's going on with one of Seattle's biggest employers. We started with Amazon stock being at an all-time high. I mean, what big picture, what's all this add up to for Amazon these days and, of course, for our region?
Historically, there has been a ton of questions over whether Amazon can turn profits.
That's what we did. Every quarter, we said that.
Now, what you've seen is Amazon use a related business, Amazon Web Services, their cloud computing business and storage business, to basically support the rest of the company. It's really fascinating how this has happened. And that's, in many ways, removed a lot of the doubts about Amazon's financial viability. The questions now aren't so much, can Amazon turn a profit? It's, will they turn the dials to turn a profit this quarter? And how will they spend their money more cautiously? And then the question is long-term, can they build a fourth and a fifth big core to their business that'll drive their growth down the road? And things like logistics. So they initially built Amazon Web Services for themselves, essentially. It was taking their own online infrastructure and basically selling it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You could see them doing very much the same thing with their logistics business, where they've got trucks and delivery vehicles, planes, and now even boats that are traversing the world. Very easily, they could turn that into something that they sell capacity to other companies through. So this is really a company without a lot of limits. And I think you're seeing that optimism reflected in the stock price.
So in the spring of 2017, we don't see an end, whether you like it or not, whether you like the changes Amazon's brought to Seattle or not, no end in sight for now.
Right now, certainly you don't want to be too bullish on this. I mean, anything can happen, but this is one of the most remarkable companies in the world.
Todd Bishop, co-founder of GeekWire. Always good to see you. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
And finally, on KUOW's The Record, we've just learned no property tax increase for Seattle after all to address homelessness. Seattle's mayor, Ed Murray, wanted a property tax increase to double what the city spends addressing homelessness. So more housing, rent subsidies, 24-hour shelters, mental health treatment, addiction treatment. And a few minutes ago, Murray pulled that idea and said instead he's supporting a county-wide, so not just Seattle, but a King County sales tax increase of 0.1%. That would have to go to the voters. KUOW's Kate Walters was at the announcement. She'll be reporting through the day on that, and you'll hear more tomorrow here on KUOW's The Record.